Welcome, everyone. We're back again, live from the Peloton. I'm sitting here with Lionel Burney to introduce and preview the new episode that I've sat down with Jens Kirkelere, my teammate in EF Education First, but longtime friend from Orica Green Edge and Green Edge back in the day. Classics man, West Flanderan, Jensy, as I like to call him. It's an epic episode. Lionel, welcome to the episode. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks, Mitch. Yeah, I've listened to your interview with Jens already. I just want to give the listeners a bit of a heads up. Head over to YouTube, check out our show notes, because early on in this conversation, Mitch, you talk about Jens's first big win in a race called Le Samin in 2010 and a really unusual sprint finish. And it's worth watching it just to get the context for when you hear Mitch and Jens talking about how that race finish panned out. So check the show notes and there'll be a link to the YouTube highlights of that race. It's about a 10-minute clip of the finale of the race, but you could skip through and watch the last couple of minutes and just see what Mitch and Jens are talking about.
It's definitely worth it. That we talk about the sprint there, and like Lionel said, skip through the last K. It's pretty epic, because this is when I discovered who Jens was. This was early in my career as well, and I was like, oh my god, who is this guy? And then I soon found out who he was. We explain all this in the podcast coming up. It's a really great podcast. We talk about life as a Belgian, Flanders, the races, what that means to them, a little bit about coronavirus as well. There's some interesting stuff in there. So sit back and enjoy this one, guys. I know you will. Cheers. Well, welcome, Jens Kirkelere. Now, if I pronounce that correctly, Jens, do the proper pronunciation for me. Kirkelere. Yeah. All right, because I've been saying it wrong my whole life, but yeah. Ultimately people say my name wrong when they're not from Australia, so you roll with it. But welcome to the pod, mate. I know you're a big fan of the pod, and we've both got our matching coffee mugs this morning, so yeah. I'm happy to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here as well. I think I can say I'm a fan of the first hour. Really excited to be here. I'm actually a little bit nervous now.
Well, I was telling you just before we pressed record, I was a little bit nervous because you think you know someone, and we had a good amount of time together. I came into the Peloton more or less at the same time. I was a year before you, and then afterwards we ended up in the same team in Orica Green Edge, and I felt we're a little bit the same when we came into Green Edge, because we were both a couple of years of pro under our belt, but fresh into a World Tour team, and we sort of bonded really quickly and became good mates there. And we had a couple of years apart, but we're back together again in EF Education First. So yeah, it's been a good little friendship there. And also, like I said, I thought I knew you, but taking the layers back, I was like, oh, I don't actually know this guy that well. Let's get into it. To give everyone a little bit of background about Jens, because people mightn't know exactly who you are, and what I want to focus on today is, Jens, you're a true Belgian, you're a classics man, you're from Bruges, or Brugge, which is the capital of West Flanders. Let's talk about, for you, my first memory as you as a pro. I was a year ahead of you, so I was starting to get the feeling, it was my second year pro, it was your first year, I was starting to get the feeling of how hard the racing really was then. It was actually, you got like, wow, that was really hard last year, and then win races that people don't necessarily know. And a race like Le Samin, to give everyone a bit of example of this race, 16 sectors of cobbles. The Belgians have dubbed it as like a mini Roubaix. I love that, because it is a tough little race, but it's a prestigious little race because guys like McEwen have won it, Gilbert's won it, Demar, Nicky Terpstra. It has the makings of a classics rider. And to give you everyone a bit of an example here, it's 2010, Jens' first year with Cofidis, and I'll set up the finish of this race because I think this is pretty special, and it sticks in my memory so well. There's a small bunch coming to the finish, and Nico Siemens is leading the bunch out. He's a Cofidis rider, Jens' teammate. He's leading this small bunch out, and then the camera follows the sprint, and the bunch sprints out on the right. And so they're following this bunch, and all these guys are hitting off, but you can't see any other Cofidis riders. You think, what's this guy been leading out? Who's he even leading out? Suddenly the camera pans back and there's this guy solo on the left. Red guy, Cofidis, Jens. It's a slightly uphill sprint. Jens is bread and butter and he just solos away to victory. And from that moment there, the Neo Pro has arrived. And following that, he goes on to win 3 Days of West Flanders, the GC, and Nokere Course, which are very prestigious races before the big classics. Jens, before I go on anymore, tell me about that day, your first win as a pro La Samin.
Oh, what an intro. I'm speechless. Yeah, very special for me as well. I think, like you said, it really made me as a cyclist for the rest of my career. And it was a huge surprise for me because, so as you said, it was my first year as a professional. As under 23, I was always good. I won my races, but I was never going to be the rider that said, okay, my first year pro, I'm going to win races. Just finishing them or like doing my job for the team would have been great already. But then to win races already as a Neo, that, yeah, I never expected that. And the year started actually really good. I started in Mallorca, had some top 10 results there, like I think even a fourth or a fifth. Then Algarve, I finished one stage third behind Contador and Sanchez, which wasn't bad as well. But then I got sick. I had a stomach flu. I think I didn't touch the bike for 5 or 6 days. Started riding a little bit again. And then Samaden was actually the first race I was going to do again. But I had no hopes of getting a good result because I hadn't been feeling good. Like I had a really bad stomach flu. But I started the race and obviously I wasn't feeling that bad. And the closer we get to the finish, the better I felt. And then, as you mentioned as well, Nico Samus, he did a really good job in leading me out. Not only that, during the race, especially when we came into the final, he really gave me the morale of saying, hey man, you can do this. He has actually been really important for me in the early years of my career. Like the whole winter, we trained a lot together, and I think he was around 10 years older than me, so he gave me a lot of advice. And yeah, he gave me a good pep talk in saying that, come on, I'll do the lead out and you'll be able to finish close. And yeah, it was crazy. I remember just going all the way to the other side of the road because the wind was coming a little bit from the left and you had the fences. So I thought, oh, I'm going to be a little bit more protected. And as soon as I hit out, the finish line was the only thing I thought about, and yep, I won it. So that was pretty special.
It was. I want to talk about this sprint actually because it was so far out from what, and it seems like you're going forever. And like you just said, then yes, the wind was coming from the left, but technically, if you went to the left, everyone could get a sit off you. You just weren't worried about that. You're like, and when you watch the sprint too, you come from the back. I'm going to have to put this video up for everyone to see because it's quite an amazing sprint. And you come from the back, which makes it feel like Nico wasn't actually leading you out per se. He was keeping that speed there. Can you take your mind back to that feeling before then? Did you have the confidence that you were going to win that day, or you just thought, well, I've got to put a good result in here. I've just got to try.
Yeah, I just had the idea of getting a good result. But the finish, like when you see it on footage, it doesn't really show how hard that finish line actually is. It changed a little bit. The race now has changed a little bit from then, but it was a big road. I think the last 3-4 k's were always gradually a little bit uphill. And it's a hard race, so nobody's really fresh anymore in the final.
And it's a very hard race.
Yeah, and Nico, he was just keeping the pace really high. And I think one moment you see him look back and you see that he sees me. It just keeps the speed as high as possible. And I remember from the races that I won as under 23, I was always good in a finish like that when it was a little bit uphill. I know myself. I know that I can go from a long way out. So I had that confidence, and I actually still have it now, that when it's a hard finish, I can go from a long way out. And I think I went at 300 meters to go, so a little bit before everybody else went. And I think that's why when I went to the left, nobody followed me because I thought, oh, this is still way too long. But I managed to keep it all the way to the finish. So yeah, that was good.
It was great because I always remember coming across the line like, who won? Who was this guy? And then we saw the footage back. I'm like, oh, this guy won. And I soon got to know your name very much quickly because, like I said, the next sort of 3-4 weeks, you were the guy in the front in the next races. What I want to go ahead and talk about now is you've then sort of made yourself into a classics man, and that's no surprise for me from where you're from. And that's what I want to get into now a little bit is something that I've got to understand throughout my career is West Flanders, East Flanders, Flanders is the heart of Belgian cycling. Cobblestones, those races we all know, we all grow up to watch, cyclists anyway, watch and, you know, love. You grew up in that region, you know, like I said, with Bruges being the capital of West Flanders. This is, for me, I get this feeling like you potentially could be sitting in your front yard and you watch the race go past your front in the street. It's that sort of feeling. It's like in Australia, growing up in Richmond, playing for the Richmond, you know, Tigers in the AFL team. It's sort of what you're supposed to do. That's the feeling I have.
Yeah.
And you've gone on and you've finished top 10 in, four times top 10 in Dwars door Vlaanderen, which is, you know, the race through Flanders, you know, top 10 in E3, also another prestigious, very prestigious Vlaanderen race, top 10 in Roubaix, not necessarily a Flanders race, but it's the cobbles, second in Gent Wevelgem, and you've also won two times Tour of Belgium. So your palmarès also says that you are a classics man. What I want to go back and try and work out is, when did this start as a young guy growing up, a Belgian guy? Is it just something you're expected to do, or how is that as a young guy growing up in West Flanders with this racing around you?
I would say we take it for granted, but it's almost like it's normal. Like you said, I grew up in Bruges, Tour of Flanders used to start in Bruges for as long as I can remember. So every year that was like a thing. We would wake up, go to the Grote Markt and go and watch the riders sign on. And then the whole afternoon you watch television. You watch Flanders on television. And also, I remember when we used to go on holidays, we always went to the Alps. It was usually 2 weeks. But my dad, he always made sure that one of the stages of the tour passed really close to where we were. So I always found that it was normal. You see cycling races, it's something normal, but it's only... When I grow up, I actually realize it's not that normal for everybody in the world. But I think it's also, I'm the only one in my family that raced. Like my dad, he had a bike, but I think everybody in Belgium, they have a race bike. But I'm actually the first one in the whole family to start racing. So yeah, it's really special to have come this far. But actually never, like I remember when I started racing, I did it because it was fun. And I never thought, maybe one day I'll make it as a professional or be able to race Tour of Flanders. Like I remember standing there or like start of Flanders or watching a stage in the Tour de France. I never thought that maybe I could be one of them. It's only really late. Like I only started racing when I was 16 that I started cycling. But still then the first 3-4 years, I never thought, maybe I'll be able to get a career out of this, but it did. So yeah, that's pretty special.
So your dad necessarily wasn't a racer. He was just a fan of cycling, as you said, and maybe most people than not were fans of cycling in your region or in West Flanders or in Flanders. It was just a commonality where you went to school. And did you speak about cycling at school between friends?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah. It's not the number one sport. I think football is still the number one sport in Belgium, but cycling, a couple of weeks in the year, it's by far the number one sport. Like during the classics, during the tour, when the world's on, the nationals, then it's like a really big thing. And that's what everybody talks about. So for me, it feels like it's just a normal thing that everybody knows a little bit about cycling. They know the names, they know the races, but it's actually not.
Well, then you sort of talked about a little bit before, and this is something that expectation, because you're like, I never thought I was going to be a pro rider. Then I became pro, but I never thought then I was going to be a guy racing these classics or the tour. But actually now you're not only racing those races, you're at the pointy end of those races. What is that like, that expectation? Is it a helpful thing growing up in these regions, in this part of Belgium where, like you said, everyone knows about it? I can imagine that could also be a helpful thing, but that also could be a hard thing because everyone does know about it. If you're not going well, there's this expectation you've got to go well. You're the guy from Bruges who should be at the front of the classics. So what is it like growing up with that expectation? Well, having that expectation now, sorry.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, especially for me, coming in with the professionals and winning races that early in my career, Maybe put a little bit of pressure on me. I remember after those races, we went to the classics when I was a Neo Pro, and everybody already expected me to, like, not, I wouldn't say win, like Dwars de Vlaanderen or not the big ones, but the ones just below that. But like, I was good enough to win those races, but the classics, that's just a whole other level. And you do feel a little bit more pressure, but I've always, as long as I felt every year that I was progressing and getting better in those races, I was happy. The longer you race, the more you realize that it's not easy to win, like just to ride a final or to be close in the final, in the classics. I would keep trying every year, but it's not easy.
Well, it mightn't be easy for you, but I tell you what, it's a hell of a lot harder for us who aren't from the region. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand who haven't raced through these races themselves, but it's literally like a maze. And I mean, you think you know your roads around wherever you live, but Belgium's a whole other level because there are a million roads. And we seem to crisscross and looped around and do all these roads. That's what it feels like. It feels like a spider web. For the guys from Flanders, though, everyone alludes to it. It's like racing in your home backyard. You know the roads like the back of your hand. But something that I think really helps to that is the memories. And I was speaking to another guy before this podcast just to get a bit of an idea of that feeling. And he was telling me, he goes, the way I learnt the roads was subconsciously. We used to have the TV on every Saturday, every Sunday, watching the races. And I wasn't really into cycling that much, but we always watched the race. And one thing that stuck in his mind, he said, was Johan Museo up the 10 bosser, that was that climb. That's how I remembered that climb. And then on that corner, there was a crash. And then on that set of, cobbles, so-and-so attacked. So the whole lot of Flanders for him has memories. It's not like he's learning the roads like when I came. Oh, yeah, that's the Quaremont, that's right. And then after that, there's the big road and yada, yada. For him, it was memories of different stuff that happened in the races. Is that sort of how it happened for you with learning the roads?
Yeah, that's exactly true. I can imagine if you're not from Belgium and you don't speak the language, it's a maze. Because we have all these bergs here. We have the Paterberg, the Canarieberg, the Valkenberg. It's already, if we would translate it in English, it would make it a little bit easier. But still, there's so many bergs you have to remember. And that's true for us. It has a lot to do with memories. Like one memory that I do have, the first time that I did Quaremont, Patersberg, Koppenberg, was with my father and my cousins. Can't remember which race it was, but we had a family get together, and one of the classics was on. And I remember one of my cousins telling me, can't be that hard, the cobbles and the climbs, they're all suffering and pushing so hard, it can't be that hard. And my dad said, well, next week we'll go up there. Here we go in one of my dad's blue vans, put all the bikes in there, and we'll just do like a little loop. And I remember we did the Eddie Merckx route. It's a route with signs. It's still there now. And it starts on the Kleusberg, and then you go to Quaremont, Patersberg, do some other climbs. And then the Koppenberg, which is probably one of the hardest, wasn't in there, but we did it anyway, just to try. So that were some good first memories. Like the first time you really get to know that region and those climbs. And especially the Koppenberg. I remember we were all standing at the bottom on our bikes, and we would each try just to get to the top without falling off. So yeah, that's true. You have a lot of memories with a lot of those things. Like I remember I did this one really long training ride with a friend in the Vlaamse Ardennen, in the region of Tour of Flanders, and we punctured somewhere on the Paddenstraat, and we changed the tire, and we left the tire there. Put it around like a light pole or whatever, and then a couple of days later there was a race there, and the tire was still there. So that's
you saw it on the TV.
Yeah, it was still there. So no, that's definitely true. You have a lot of memories, and that makes it a lot easier to remember all the different cobblestone sections and climbs.
Yeah, totally. And everyone has that feeling from their own area, and it might necessarily be that you race there, but you go training or whatever, and you're like, oh yeah, last week or that happened there. And I just think like it was such a great point that you remember it like that. you don't actually think about that at that moment when you're going up the Koppenberg, but there's a personal connection to it. It doesn't necessarily have to be a race-winning moment at all. It's just more, oh yeah, I got dropped at that moment. And like, we come as foreigners to the region and we slowly create our memories, but that's when we're racing. Whereas you've already got those memories laid day one when you start racing. And I think that's when we talk about you guys having that advantage, I see that as a massive advantage. And at the end of it, yes, you still have to be physically good and you have to know how to race, but knowing the course is already done and you're like, all right, let's just race.
And it makes a huge difference if you pass there in the race or if you can pass there on training or like silly things like going and try to do all the climbs with the family, because in the race, everything happens so fast. You have the sports director yelling in your ear that it's a left and a right and then this climb and that climb, and it's easy to forget where the hell you are. But then on training, you see everything a little bit better. And yeah, I think definitely if you're not from here and you come here the first couple of times, it's not easy to remember everything.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, of course, to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Gymshark. Richard, who are Gymshark? Are you a Gymshark?
Well, I mean, there's you know, the shark for us obviously only means one thing, doesn't it? Vincenzo Nibali, but it's got nothing to do with Vincenzo Nibali or Messina. It's gym kit, gym gear, but not just gym gear, it's sports clothing. And you and I, Lionel, have been lucky enough to receive a little bundle of goods. In fact, I believe we're both wearing our green track shorts, aren't we? Embarrassingly enough. Luckily, we can't see each other.
We are indeed. Yeah, we're not in the same room, but we are clashing. We've come in the same outfit today.
It's going to be awful at the tour, isn't it? Or wherever we happen to be on the road, if we're wearing the same clothing. Oh, dear. Anyway, I must say that I'm very impressed by, got a lot of wear out of already, the base layer. I got a short sleeve and a long sleeved element base layer. Very reasonably priced and really comfortable and really good for cycling because they're very long in the body, so when you're hunched over your bars it doesn't ride up the back. And I wore that a couple of days ago for a long bike ride and found it exceptionally comfortable.
Well, I ordered I got the shorts and the hoodie. What I went for mostly was stuff that I can wear after I've got back from a bike ride and I've had a shower and I'm kind of relaxing and I'm feeling, you know, a post-workout feeling.
For the massage.
Yeah, before the massage and the refueling, of course, Richard. Just very comfortable clothing to wear. The hoodie in particular, you know, very nice garment with a full zip and obviously a hood. And I've also gone for that in green. I hope you haven't ordered the hoodie in green as well, Richard.
Petrol blue for me, oh, Lionel.
What a relief. Well, if you want to check out Gymshark's range of clothing, whether you're cycling or running, I've actually ordered a couple of T-shirts for running in as well. So, you know, real versatile range of clothing. Go to gymshark.com/thecyclingpodcast. That's gymshark.com/thecyclingpodcast. Now let's get back to Mitch's conversation with Jens Kukulera.
Now, let's want to talk a little bit about the current state. And this is something I haven't talked too much about in the podcast because I feel like everyone is, it's on everyone's mind anyway. So we don't need to get continually reminded about it. But it's their coronavirus and the lockdown life, something that everyone has gone through. So everyone can relate to what is happening at the moment. But I think not many people can relate as closely as you can because you actually had coronavirus early in lockdown. Tell me about that, Jens.
3 weeks after opening weekend, I got to say, I think the weekend after opening weekend, lockdown started in Belgium. And then 2 weeks after that, I got really sick. I had a fever for almost 10 days. And the first 3 days were really, really high fever. That was the only symptom that I had. I didn't have I didn't lose my smell, I didn't lose my taste, I didn't have the dry cough, like all the other symptoms you would typically have with the coronavirus, I didn't have. And it never really got to a point that it was that bad that I had to go to the hospital to, it didn't never really get that critical. It was just, I think normally when you have a flu, you have fever for 2 or 3 days and then it's over. So it did bother, worry me a little bit that it was 10 days, but in the end, there wasn't anything else I could do. Like, there wasn't antibiotics you could take. You just had to, yeah.
How'd you know you had it?
Only 3 weeks ago now. We were able to do some tests here in Belgium.
At the time, you didn't know you had it?
No, I didn't know. And I think if I would have known, the weeks after would have been maybe a little bit different, because yeah, I had contact with the doctors every day, and they said it's possible you have it, but it's also possible you don't have it. I had my last day of fever, then I waited another week, then I started, I wouldn't call it training, but just moving a little bit, doing some rides with the family on the bike, and then gradually progressing a little bit. But then the third week that I started riding again, I had a really bad, setback. I didn't get sick, but I just had almost a full week that I was dead tired. Like, I could do just the normal things at home, but as soon as I tried to get on the bike or like exercise a little bit, I wasn't able to do it. So I had another week almost that I didn't do anything. And then after that, I started feeling better and better. And I think that's almost 5-6 weeks ago now. And I just had like a first 3 week block now that's finished, where I actually feel normal again. I feel like a cyclist again. But
so you were saying that later on you found out, just recently you found out that you had it.
Yeah, so I think 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were able to do the test in Belgium where they could see if you have antibodies in the blood. So I did it, and it said like that I had the virus. And then actually the thing that I was a little bit worried about, I think in the end, we will all have to do it, or at least everybody that's been positive and wants to start racing again, they have to do an extra test for the heart and then for the lungs. Basically, the tests we have to do in the winter to get our license. I had to do it again now just to see if the virus didn't affect anything there. So I was a bit nervous for that. Remember the morning that I had to do the tests, my wife, Sheena, she said, aren't you a little bit nervous? And actually, up until that moment, I was okay, but she planted the seed in my head, and I started, I really started to get a little bit worried. Come to the hospital, and normally I just had to do the test in rest, but the doctor said, to be sure, we'll put you on the bike, do like the bike test, and that really got me worried. In the end, everything was good, so they didn't see any problems with the heart. Also, the lungs were good. So, that was a bit...
Did you think back on the time and go, once you got the positive test back afterwards, once you were feeling well, did you think, oh my God, yeah, that makes sense now? Or did you already think that when you had the sickness that you had for coronavirus?
Yeah, after 10 days of fever, I it's like what the doctor said. It's possible you had it, but yeah, we're not really sure. It's not like when I had the test that I saw, I had it. Yeah. When did I have this? No, okay. I definitely know when I had it, and it made sense.
And there was no worry about passing it on to your kids and your wife?
Well, that was the thing. So the moment that I had fever, the rules in Belgium were we could still go outside for a run or for a walk. It wasn't like in Spain and Italy that we had to stay inside. And if you had it, yeah, you had to make like a little quarantine for yourself, but... Yeah, I have two kids. We're all living in the same house. I think it didn't make any point of me staying in my room for the next 10 days, because if I have it then, they probably already had it as well. So,
They never contracted it?
Well, they haven't been tested. My youngest son, he was sick before me, so it might be that I got it from him. But then my oldest son, he didn't have anything. And my wife, she was really tired for like almost a week. Like I was sleeping a lot, obviously, but she was sleeping the same hours as I was. Back then, we thought that it was just a situation. We had two kids at home. They sucked the energy right out your body. So we just thought it was that. Like also, I was sick, so I wasn't able to do that much... Like I always tried to do as much as possible, but those 10 days wasn't that easy to do a lot. So we just thought, she's tired because of the kids and the whole situation. but it might be that she had it as well, and that were her symptoms.
It's interesting. It's really interesting because we all, you know, understanding now it was so contagious and, you know, it was so drastic for some people, but it's just so different for everyone. And I think the point here is that, you know, you can, if you're fit and healthy, like you said, maybe your wife had it, but it affected her in another way. Yeah. It wasn't life-threatening. Not that we need to go, oh, yeah, it's all okay for everyone, but I think it's very difficult to sort of get the real truth of what coronavirus is and how it affects us, because it's in the media. We only see the, you know, the most drastic cases,
yeah,
with deaths and things like that. So it's interesting to hear from, you know, someone who's actually had it. And someone who's in a similar position to me. I've got two kids. I'm also a sportsman. So I'm just wondering what it would be actually like. So
it wasn't that much fun. So you're not missing anything.
I'm happy to hear the story, but I don't necessarily need to do it myself. What I want to talk about too is, and you spoke about a little bit then, is lockdown life. And lockdown life has been different for everyone. For me, it was like a whole bunch of Zwift stuff and then training outside again. And I didn't necessarily love the first time I went back outside, but I'm back in now, a good routine. And now it's about focusing on, we've actually got a goal now, goalposts. But before that, it was sort of training to keep fit. And you sort of spoke a little bit about that. What was that like for you in lockdown? And how did you go about that with an idea of there might be racing at the end of the year? What was your whole theory in it?
Yeah, well, for me, it was obviously a little bit different. I think it's been almost 16 weeks now since the lockdown. And I can say more than half of it was just feeling better again. Like, I was never really thinking on just maintaining the form, because the form was completely gone. I didn't touch the bike for 17 days. And then, yeah, for 2-3 weeks after that, I just felt that the body wasn't normal. There was still something different. But now the last 4 or 5 weeks, it's been going better. And like you say, we all know a little bit when we're going to start racing again. I don't know my program yet, but we all know it's going to be in August. And it makes a huge difference, I find, that you have that goal. You know when you're supposed to be good again. So you can actually plan something together with the trainer. And it makes a huge difference mentally, I think. I hear from a lot of riders now that, and for me it was different, because that 1 or 2 months that we were training for nothing was difficult, but I didn't have it. I was just sick and recovering. But a lot of guys, they say, yeah, you just do whatever, but you didn't really have a goal, and it made it hard sometimes just to, yeah, train without a goal. I think now it's a lot different because we actually have that goal, and I think gives a little bit more motivation to hurt yourself on training.
Yeah, and I think that's a funny thing, because like, I was out there riding and I was like, I should be just enjoying this fact that I can actually ride for once without having to do efforts or, you know, 5 hours. I could just do 3 hours or 1 hour or whatever, not even focusing on time, just doing a ride. But it was so funny because it was so foreign to me.
Yeah.
I'd never done that. And I was like, I couldn't work it out. I'm like, why can't I just enjoy riding? Because in a sick way, we like having that focus, that reason to push ourselves, that reason to do efforts, that come home feeling of, I've done it, it's in the bank, it's all good. And for me, it wasn't the same feeling, that joyous feeling of just riding, just a ride.
I actually have it a lot, that when you're racing and when you're training for some goals, that you think, oh, how nice would it be just to ride for a week or 10 days, like do a big trip. And if you want to stop somewhere for some food or drink, you stop somewhere. If you want to relax, you relax. And if you want to go 9 hours, you do 9 hours. It's actually, I have it a lot in the season that I think, oh, would be nice just to ride, not do anything else than that. Not having to do 20-40s and efforts and this and that, just ride. But
right, but so did you even get to experience that, or were you just still too sick?
No, I felt way too sick. I was just riding. I wasn't doing any efforts, but it's just, yeah, I felt on the bike for a very long time that there was something wrong. And yeah, you don't want to push it. You don't want to ride too long. And it's also not knowing when it's going to get better that made it a little bit more difficult. And you saw a lot, like in Belgium for, like, I think the first 4 weeks in Belgium, the first 4 weeks of the lockdown, like the big cities, Brussels, Antwerp, Ghent, they were dead. And a lot of guys that did it, they just rode there with the bike and rode through Brussels on roads where normally you would never be able to go because of the traffic. And it actually looked like a lot of fun. So I missed that. I wasn't able to do that.
Well, let's go back and talk about the classics now, because I think something that's going to be really funny this year is racing these races at the end of the year. Not only is it going to be different sort of temperature and climate and a feeling where the leaves are going to be falling from the trees opposed to sprouting out in spring, that's going to have a different effect. I think also that's also going to have a psychological effect, because we've been racing for, you know, 10, 12 years in the peloton, and the season has a flow for us. I don't know if you've noticed this yourself, but for me, we're in June, and all of a sudden, I want to push myself. The sun's hot. That's when I usually train for the summer, you know, getting ready for me, the end of the season, the Vuelta or whatever it is. And I'm naturally doing that now, even though those races aren't going to be there in their normal spot. My body's naturally following a sort of flow. So I'm wondering how it's going to be racing full tilt classics at the end of the year, when generally at the start of the year you're so motivated for it, the spring's there, and now at the end of the year when you're normally like, season's rolling in, and it's like, all right, Mitch, Roubaix, what are you thinking? Because as I'll just quickly run through, as the season sits, I've got the calendar here, you know, we're going to have Gent-Wevelgem, starting with Gent-Wevelgem on the 11th of October, Skelderprijs on the 14th, then you've got Flanders on the 18th, Dupont on the 21st, and Roubaix, finishing with Roubaix on the 25th of October, which is essentially the last race of the year. The Vuelta is still going to be going on then, but 25th of October, like, if you're still racing then, it's normally somewhere in China on holiday tour.
Yeah.
Or you're completely done, would have been done for 2 weeks. What are you thinking about this? What are your thoughts? What are the Belgians thinking?
I think it's going to be different for a couple of reasons. I think One factor that's going to be important is probably a lot of guys will have done a Grand Tour already. I think you know as well that if you've done a Grand Tour, it makes a big difference in how you feel after that. Then a second thing is the weather. I think chances of bad weather in October or in March or April, I think it's pretty similar. But it's the biggest difference is in the head, I think. You know, in March, April, it's possible you have some bad weather and some rain, but you know, okay, it's the classics. It's part of the classics. But then in October, you also know that it's going to rain, but then it's like, oh, I don't want it to rain. You just really, really hope that it's going to be like good weather and dry. Maybe it's going to be different now because it's still the classics. It's Flanders Roubaix. But for me, like, I usually go well in bad weather, or I wouldn't say well, but I'm not getting a lot worse in bad weather, except when it's in October. Then it's really you don't really want it anymore. So I think that's some things that are going to make it different. I think maybe a third point that might be important as well is what the roads are going to be like because of the farmers. I always know when you go riding in October here around in my region, in Flanders, the farmers, they start harvesting the corn, and the roads, they're slippery as hell. It's unbelievable.
Oh, no.
October is always really dangerous. You hear a lot of crashes and accidents in October just because of that. So I'm curious how that's going to be when we have to race on it. So I think that might be different as well. And not only for Flanders, I think for Roubaix as well, the cobbles. If you ride them any other time in the year than in the classics, they're always a little bit different. So I'm really curious how that's going to be as well.
Have you ridden the cobbles at different times of the year in Roubaix?
Yes. Roubaix under 23 was always the last week of June. That's actually funny. The three times I did it, it was always in the rain. A professional, I've never done any Roubaix in the rain. But as under 23, every year it was wet.
In June as well, it should be dry then.
Yeah. So yeah, that was different. And also there's a lot more grass in between the cobbles. I've done it twice in the stage in the Tour, and it's completely different. I would almost say that it's easier because the grass in between the cobbles makes it a more flat surface. and it's actually not that hard. So it makes a huge difference in tire pressure and just the feel on the cobbles as well. So I'm not sure at the end of the season how that's going to be, but it's definitely going to be different than in April.
Yeah, because like when I used to live in Belgium once upon a time, and I stayed 1 year late in the season for a guy's wedding, and I have a feeling it was late in October, but I always remember it was cold then. It was actually much colder than, say, the spring, because Roubaix typically is at the end of the classic, so really in spring, and it's getting quite warm then. So I'm thinking like the end of October, it's going to be, whether it's dry or wet, it's still going to be much colder.
Yeah. Yeah, usually Flanders and Roubaix, like I've only had it also one time that Flanders was still really cold, but usually those two races are the first races that the weather is getting a little bit warmer. And that's true, it's going to be different in October. And I always, like cyclocross season starts usually in September, but it's in October that we really start to watch it. And the Koppenbergcross is always 1st of November, I think, or early November. And if you think about the bad Koppenbergcross editions there has been in the last 10 years, you really start to think, oh, and we have Roubaix on that day. So, you just know that odds are against us to have a good weather Roubaix this year. I don't mind that it's going to rain, but if it's raining and 5 degrees, nobody's going to be happy with that, I think.
Oh, mate. Well, you've set it up, Yenzi. I tell you what, I did say this a few years ago too, that I wouldn't mind doing a wet Roubaix, but we just reconned a wet Roubaix a couple of years ago, and it was ended up the Roubaix was dry, but 2 days before it was wet. And you said you've raced it on a wet Roubaix. I tell you what, I was so scared.
Yeah,
I was really, I couldn't control the bike on the few sectors we did, and I was thinking, how could I ever race this?
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was like when you raced under 23 in the wet, but what are your thoughts if there was a wet Roubaix?
It's completely different. My memories from under 23 aren't that clear anymore, but I do remember when I did the stage in the Tour in 2014 when Lars Boom won. That was just, I really liked it. I think I finished fifth or sixth, so I had a really good race that day, and I liked it, but it's because I got... You were racing in the front, and everything was going as I hoped it was going to be. But I think it could have been like a really bad day as well. From the stories I've heard afterwards, that everywhere between position 20th and 160th, it was the most horrible day of their lives. But it's crazy. Like you hit the cobblestones sectors, and you know, okay, if something happens now in front of me, that's it's over. You can't do anything.
You can't stop.
One thing I remember as well is the first two or three cobblestone sections we did that year, you just see guys flying left and right. Like the first three cobblestone sections, you just saw crashes everywhere. Like guys going straight in corners, left, right, punctures. Some guys tried to go in the gutter, but the water was so high that you couldn't really see if it was like a deep water or... It was just, but I really liked it. I had a good day. It was also, like I said, it was wet, but it wasn't cold. I think it was still between 15 and 20 degrees. So the race was that hard. You never got cold. It was special. I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Well, Yenzi, you've set it up, mate. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the pod today. And I can't wait to catch up with you. It's still going to be a couple of months away, but I'm hoping that you're going to be on the Classics program as well with me, and we can spend some time up there in Belgium and experience this. I think, look, I'm saying it now, I'm probably going to hate it at the time and love it afterwards, but it's going to be a really special moment to race these races, whatever races we're all doing at the end of the year.
Yeah.
It's going to be weird. It's going to be different. There's going to be different winners, and I'm hoping I can pull some success out of this as you get my head around it and get into this racing at the end of the year.
Yeah. I hope so too. It's definitely gonna be something. I just hope that we're gonna be able to finish the program as it is now. I think everybody's gonna be happy with that. And thank you, Mitch, for having me on Life in the Peloton.
Cheers, mate. Well, there we have it. Big Yenzi giving us a little bit of an insight to what this year is going to be like, plus what life was like with coronavirus. I tell you what, it was actually a bit of a scary insight there to hear that he had it and then he didn't really know he had it. And I think everyone's probably been in that situation or can relate to that situation of that thought of like what that would be like, or, you know, what life is really like in lockdown. So I tell you what, it was a really, really interesting chat with Jens. And by the end of the chat, I was actually getting very, very excited about the classics again, which doesn't take a lot for me, but I love talking about the cobblestones and just hearing him talk about riding across the cobblestones at different times of year. I started getting really excited again. What do you think of the episode there, Lionel?
It was great, Mitch. I mean, let's go back to the beginning to start with and just remind people, if you've listened to the episode and you want to check out the sprint finish that you talked about at the start, we posted a link to YouTube in the show notes. But what I love about that and the fact that Cucalera is a true Flandrian, born in Bruges, but Le Samin is, it's such a hipster's race now. It's such a hipster's Flandrian classic. It doesn't even take place in Flanders. It's actually just over the border in Wallonia, isn't it? But it still fits into that part of the season. And I was just reflecting on how, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you'd never have got to watch that race on TV in the UK. But now it's a real kind of midweek treat for the, I was going to say for the purists, but there's something really, you know, stripped down about a race like that. You know, it's just a hard afternoon out racing. And, well, as you, if you watch the clip, you'll see the riders in three-quarter length leggings and winter gloves. You know, it's a day when you have quite some effort taken to get up to, you know, get the body temperature up. But you mentioned the coronavirus and just hearing him talk about having the test just to check that it's not done any kind of lasting damage to his system. With, I mean, that had me on tenterhooks a little bit. And I'm sure that there's, you know, there's going to be some worrying times for riders, you know, who may have had the virus but without even knowing it, and will get tested and find that they've got antibodies. And I think, you know, that uncertainty really came across listening to Jens talk about going through the illness and really saying it's not something that you want to risk getting.
Yeah, totally. And just to go back on what you were saying, is something we've missed from this year and we're definitely going to miss with the classics being at the end of the year. Suddenly we're going to be at the biggest races all of a sudden. Whereas before, we had these beautiful races to build us up, to get the palate sort of salivating, getting ready. You know, La Samin, you had Nokere course, you had West Flanders, you had these races to sort of get yourself ready, and then the next week you had the big boys. All of a sudden this year, we're going to be straight into the big boys. And so it's going to be a bit of a shock. And I personally loved feeling and watching those races or doing those races, preparing for the classic season. But all of a sudden, I'm going to have to be ready day one. Come Gent-Wevelgem, I'm going to have to be firing. So it's definitely going to be a really different situation, let alone at the end of the year. Who knows? And I'm just trying to get my head around it. It was interesting chatting to Jens about it. And I'm actually looking forward to seeing my teammates again. So it's going to be a new thing as well. I do want to say also, guys, if you haven't had a chance to check it out, and Lionel was just talking to me about it, there's a new link up. Go across and check out the new merch. We've stocked up the shop again. Got some new stuff in there. Summer's around the corner, so I've put some singlets in there. Someone saw me running in a Life in a Peloton singlet, so they're like, I want to get my hands on one of them. I was like, all right, let's do it. Let's put them up in the shop. Lionel, what have you got there? Have you got a new link up on the website?
Well, yeah, we've actually, on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, if you click on shop, we've got a link that takes everyone straight through to your merchandise. You've got, well, you've got caps, T-shirts. You've even got a little T-shirt for toddlers, which I've got my eye on. I'm quite taken with that. I might be placing an order for one of those this week.
For yourself, is it? Are you that size, are you?
No, I want to clarify, not for... No, I have a small toddler. I think they'd look great in one of those. It'd be a bit of a stretch for me.
I thought you'd been on the full lockdown in lockdown. No, not the case.
No, I have been doing quite a bit of cycling though, Mitch. I mean, not in your league, but 10 hours a week is quite considerable for me. That's the upper end of my limits. I've been quite pleased with myself lately.
And the weather's been kind in the UK?
It has, yeah. I mean, it's a very strange feeling. You know, normally we'd be, what, 10 days away from travelling over to France for the Tour de France and daily coverage of the Tour for the cycling podcast. And to know that that isn't happening just yet is quite surreal. And every time you're talking there about the races coming round, they're going to come round in a different order. The light is going to be different. You know, I mean, I'm just thinking about all the little things that we're so used to, the rhythm of the day, race day. You know, it could be as we get into October, you know, races aren't finishing at 5 or 5.30. They'll be finishing at, you know, 3.30 or 4 just to make sure that the light's not fading. You know, there's going to be some, and it's going to be all about who adjusts to those little differences, I think. And it's going to be a fascinating period of racing.
It's going to be so bizarre. Exactly what you said, the light, the feeling of the atmosphere around the race. Like I said, the leaves falling, and I can just purely envision myself being in Italy racing Trevally, these races where there's this beautiful atmosphere around the race. It's a bit colder, the sun comes out, the day gets a bit darker earlier, and you get this feeling of, yeah, you know what, season's almost done. But, and I know I'll be able to get my head around it, but I can't feel it yet. To be going to the biggest, hardest races of the year in that slow down sort of feeling, it's going to be going against the grain, but you know, I guess we're just going to have to do it and get into it. But
do you know, Mitch, what your first race back is due to be? Are you able to confirm that yet?
Look, our team's looking at doing three little bubbles. They're going to go the Tour de France sort of bubble where they do Dauphiné and the Tour, and then you got the Giro d'Italia bubble, which will do like Torino and the Giro, roughly. You know, there's some races either side of that. And then there's the Classics crew, which will do Poland at the start of the racing, a bit of a break, and then go in for the Classics with Bing Bank and then the rest of the Classics. So that's what I'm on. I couldn't miss Roubaix. You know, I was looking forward to doing the Giro, but those two collide. And to finish the year with Roubaix, it's going to be cold. It's going to be wet. We discussed this in the pod. But I tell you what, I can't think of a better way to finish the year. It's always normally a break for me after Roubaix, but to think like, oh yeah, I'm closing the season out with Roubaix, that's just that little bit of extra motivation. Actually, it brings a smile to my face. That race is going to be it's going to be hell, but it's going to be beautiful by the time we get to the Velodrome.
Well, I mean, who knows? It could be a beautiful autumnal day, or it could be, you know, winter come early. I mean, it's the same in spring, but the sense that if a bad day in late October could be worse than a bad day in April, couldn't it? So, you know, yeah, good luck to you guys.
Definitely, yeah. I'm preparing myself for the worst. Like I said in the podcast, I've been in Belgium late October and it's cold. Even when the sun's out, it's still cold. It's not Italy. So I'm preparing myself for a cold day, a cold end of the season. Don't know how I'm going to do that, but I'm mentally psyching myself up. Hang in for the Talking Luft in 2 weeks' time back on Life in the Peloton's feed, because we get back there and we have a chat and Jens gives us some good insights to life before helmets, caps, Luft. So guys, until then, and until 2 weeks' time, thanks for tuning in. I'm Mitch Stocker. Cheers. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.